super fascinating is that you've just done an MBA, which should teach you all about business. You then go into New Covent Garden Soup, and you said you didn't really have any idea what you're doing. So I think there's real interesting learnings from what you learn in a classroom from actually what you learn doing.
Yeah.
Who was this, he or she, the chairman who came in, and what were the one to three things he or she taught you about how to run a food business successfully that you think are still relevant today?
So it's a he, it's called Jeff, and he'd worked in the food industry all his life. He'd worked for Cadbury, he'd worked for, I think his last job was, doesn't exist anymore, was Grand Met. He'd worked for dairy, you know, a lot of it had been in the dairy sector. And actually, you know, one of his jobs as a senior manager, he'd had something like 300 businesses reporting into him, which was kind of relevant because he had a sort of template for, you know, the minimum you needed to do to run a business. So, you know, because if you're doing 300 businesses, you haven't got time to do more than the minimum, but this is the kind of fail safe. And I mean, he taught me loads and loads of other things. And he taught us. Mm. And he was gracious enough to say we taught him as much, because I don't think he'd ever worked with a team of people who were quite so committed. Mm. You know, I, even though looking back on it, as I talk about Covent Garden Soup Company, I can feel my heart rate raising because all the things that went wrong there, I remember now. But at the time, I just thought I was the luckiest because I'd had this sort of, as far as I was concerned, failed career up until then, you know, doing all these amazing jobs, which my parents were proud of, a barrister, a banker, or whatever, in the city. They just didn't.
What did you feel like in here?
What, when I was doing those jobs?
I just
would come home on a Friday or at the end of the day and just think, I mean, barrister was different. I mean, I just couldn't imagine doing them forever, but being a banker or being an investment banker, you're basically a stockbroker. You're back to, you know, needing to sell something that people needed. I wasn't convinced.
Yeah, God, that's soul destroying, isn't
that
it?
Was actually, what's this for? Mm. I mean, you need them. I mean, God, I understand where they fit in. So it's great. And I was lucky enough to sort of understand how, you know, we need a financial sector. I just don't necessarily want to spend a lot of time in it. I mean, I do actually have a job in the financial sector at the moment, but it's kind of, you know, it's a non-executive job. So I see how all these things fit in, but it just didn't deliver for me. Covent Garden Soup, in its chaotic early days stage, I just thought I'm the luckiest person alive. I didn't want to go home. Mm. And so, we didn't go home. We didn't go home until very late. We just thought this is great. And there were gang, you know, a team of us doing it. But, I mean, you know, to counter that, I remember the first day that I met Jeff, the chair, he wasn't even the chairman in those days. He and I just joined on the same day to sort of as consultants. And he had boys who were kind of in their, I don't know, sort of 8-9 year old boys at the time. And he described going to watch them at the weekend playing mini rugby. And he said, you know, these young guys were just so committed. And so wherever the ball was, everybody on the pitch was on top of the ball. So if ever it got out of the kind of ruck or the mess, this kind of pile of young boys, the ball had nowhere to go. There was no one to pass it to because they were all on top of the ball. And he said, you know, that's exactly what's happening here at Covent Garden Soup Company. Everyone's in the factory. Everyone's trying to make it work. Everyone's trying to get the soup out on time. No one's playing in position. You've got to play in position. You've got to have people who are standing by. You've got to have people on the wing whose job it is to do stuff. And so, you know, everyone had sort of rather vague job descriptions, but actually they all kind of merged into one.
How many people at the time?
Well, we probably had 30, 40 people working in the factory, and then, you know, a management team. We had some engineers, and then we had a management team of, I don't know, let's say 7 or 8 of us, maybe a bit more, I don't know, you know, kind of senior management, 4 or 5, and maybe the same again. So not big, but it's a manufacturing business, so not tiny. It was, you know, we had a couple of million turnover. We were already listed in Tesco, which was then not the biggest supermarket, desperate to get into Sainsbury's, which was our target. We just couldn't get in. We were in just getting into or in Waitrose. Can't remember exactly, but, you know, it was that sort of site. And by the way, it was much easier to get into the supermarkets in those days. So any one of your listeners thinking, oh, they were well on the way. Actually, if we hadn't been in the supermarkets, we'd have been dead. You know, selling short life ready meals, the only place you could sell them was in the supermarkets because they had the, you know, the logistics infrastructure to cope. So, I mean, we were in a few London, you know, multiple independents that took it. But otherwise, the supermarkets were our customer base. So, yeah, that was what it was like. Jeff taught us, you know, so you need everyone to play in position. You need accurate weekly management numbers. They don't need to be so accurate that they're late because you need them on time. You have a weekly management meeting. The weekly management meeting doesn't last very long. The main agenda is driven by a budget, an annual budget, which we've agreed, and how we are doing against that budget, you know, this week, and what's causing the variances. Let's talk about those. And then just going through the various areas of the business. But around that very sort of narrow framework, very easy to get drift into wider issues. Just close those conversations down. That, you know, so if you're chairing it, which I was doing quite early on, saying that sounds like a great conversation for you two guys to have, but you know, let's not delay the meeting because we've got a business to run. So it was a maximum hour-long meeting, you know, action points captured. First thing we did the next week was go through the action points. If you didn't turn up to the meeting, you got a lot of action points because that was the way we made sure people turned up at the meeting. And it was kind of, there weren't really very many excuses. I mean, you were allowed to go on holiday a bit, but there weren't very many excuses for not turning up to the meeting.
Mm.
Only the senior management team, because when we first started, there were meetings going on, but they were all over the place and everybody would be in the meeting because no one was playing a position. So nobody was there representing the other people in that part of the team. So, you know, you're in charge of production. You don't need the engineers to come to the meeting because they should be fixing the filling line. So, I mean, this sounds blindingly obvious, but when you are in a fast-moving business that's not delivering what everyone wanted, you know, panic stations can easily take over. So it was just putting some order, some sense. And that's kind of where it all starts. I mean, I've been involved in so many early-stage businesses now where just introducing that level of discipline. Everyone, when you go to them, everyone says, yeah, well, we do that. Then you look and they say, well, they kind of think they're doing it, but they're not really doing it. You know, the meetings get cancelled. The meetings sort of take place at different times. So somebody misses it, you know, all that sort of stuff. So it's just really, it's being really quite disciplined. And then the weekly stuff feeds into a monthly board meeting. And so there is a formal board meeting. We had non-executive directors by then. They turn up for it. You know, this is back in the late 80s, early 90s. You wore a tie, if you're a bloke at least. And you know, I always say, I mean, I remember when I was just beginning to run it, not being able to, not having much of an appetite the day before the board meeting, and having, you know, when it worked out, when it was okay, having a sort of huge relief on the Friday lunchtime when it was over that it worked. And that sort of sense of, oh my God, I've got quite a serious meeting and I've got my investors coming and my non-executive directors. And that, you know, I'm not saying it should be intimidating, but it kind of has a bit of formality to it that you know, you don't necessarily want to deflate even in these informal times. So that is another thing that he taught me.
Quick one, guys. Espresso's have got a brand new sponsor, Unleashed. Unleashed is inventory management software that talks directly to your finance and econ software. We use Unleashed daily at Islands. I bloody love it. We've cut our admin time in half, saving approximately 30K a year. Why use it? Save money, save headaches, save stress. Get granular clarity on your margins. Know where your stock is. Don't miss availability. Look, your favorite brands literally use Unleashed as their backbone. Candy Kittens, Tiny Rebel, Trip, all use it religiously. Look, there's a link in the show notes. Please feel free to book in a call with Josh and his wonderful sales team at Unleashed. They're amazing. Even nothing comes of it. And even better news, you'll get your first month free if you reference Hungry. Thank you. Zooming out, right? Not all discipline. There are a multitude of ways to enforce discipline, but actually having a sense of intimidation can enforce discipline, right? And by intimidation, I don't mean like, oh my God, you've got to do this. But I mean like that soft kind of, as you said, I couldn't really eat the day before. And I think what you've said there is really fascinating is, you know, you work with loads of businesses. If we were to thread the needle between all these businesses, would you say, you'd say that one area is just kind of doing, Mark says this, the brilliant basics, which is like, you know, having the report on the Friday, getting the actions done on the Monday, don't miss the meeting. Yeah. Da, 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 da. What are the kind of consistent things you see food businesses and brands get wrong?
Well, I mean, you know, we've talked about the sort of basic disciplines. So, I mean, maybe this is a bit of a random one, but I think people need, you need to be realistic about the potential scale of your business and, you know, how fast you're going to get there. I've seen so many businesses where they've gone out and raised money on a promise and raised quite a lot of money, or raised it on quite a high valuation. And, you know, you look at it and you think, this is going to take way longer. And you've kind of sold 50% of the business, 60% of the business already to people who probably, in my view, should have known better. And it's just going to end in tears, because you're going to end up having to raise more money, and you're probably going to have to raise it at a lower value. And you're going to end up either not working there, because so often the founders fall out with the backers, or working for nothing because you've been so diluted. And so moving at an appropriate pace. I mean, if you're so convinced that you're onto something that's going to be an absolute winner, then, you know, raising enough money to blow the lights out, maybe it makes sense. And I'm, you know, I'm a cautious farmer, so what do I know? And, you know, you and I were talking earlier about, I mean, I've seen so many early brands and predicted that they were going to be successes or not successes, and failed to realize quite how successful they were going to be. But actually, I haven't seen that many of them. I've seen many more where people have been optimistic about things, sold, raised lots of money, and then they've, you know, they've survived. They haven't failed like, you know, others do. But the owner, the founder, has ended up with not much to show for it.
Mm.
And you kind of think, well, wouldn't it have been better to have moved at a slower pace? Would it not better, you know, have put the money you've, the expensive equity you've raised from outsiders behind things that are already working, rather than punting it all on something that you hope might work? You know, when we have spent money, whether it's at Covent Garden or Green and Blacks or whatever, on expensive marketing initiatives, it's always on, well, it's usually been, and I would say it should always have been, on things that are already working. You know, we're not going to spend it all, you know, we're not always going to spend it on expensive TV advertising or, you know, poster advertising in London, unless we've got evidence that it's already working. You know, even if it may not be perfect evidence, but we're backing something.
Is there an example to add some, bring that to life a bit?
Well, you know, I mean, we're at Green and Blacks, and you've spoken to Mark. I mean, Mark's big first campaign, you know, we put some expensive posters outside the main tube stations in London, and it was going to cost us a lot more than we had ever spent before, and we could just about afford it. But we combined it with massive distribution gains in the multiples in the stores that were near those tubes. So we used the promise of the adverts to persuade the Tesco's and the Sainsbury's and whoever else within those stores to give us, you know, extra listings, front of store exposure, so that it couldn't really fail. The advertising couldn't really fail, and you've got this sort of multiplier effect.
Mm.
So, you know, we knew that when Green and Blacks was, you know, given a prominent position, it sold much, much higher. So we knew that if we could use the extra burst of marketing to encourage the stores to give us more of that, then it was a surefire winner. So that's probably the best example I could.
What was the advert, if you can remember?
Well, I can remember the first campaign because we had the main campaign were cross track adverts. I can't remember what you call them, but those big sheet adverts, and they were all based around this discovery that it was mainly women of a certain age who ate chocolate, and it was their sort of guilty secret. And so we had this campaign of let's call her a young mum from South London, and it's dark, she's in the street, in a terrace street in Wandsworth or wherever. Her Volvo boot is open and she's unpacking, can't remember the name of the supermarket, and she's unpacking the bags, but she can't wait to get them inside the house. And so she's scoffing Green and Black's chocolate kind of rather obsessively on the street in the dark with a street light. And it just so perfectly depicted what our research said, which is that's how people felt about their chocolate. They would say, you know, they said, oh, well, when we go over green and blacks, we hide it in the back of the fridge so the rest of the family can't see it. And we sort of picked all that. And the agency sort of turned that into a really lovely advert. And people hated it. You know, this is a subversive activity. We might have told you about it. We don't have to go and turn it into a bloody great advert. So, but we had a little bit of money left. And we did these two, you know, sheets at the top of the, you know, whatever you call those, but above the seats. And they were all just talking about the provenance. They just said, you know, the vanilla that goes into our chocolate is, you know, because it's organic, is produced in this way and it's really difficult. And it was just sort of food facts. People absolutely loved those. So that shaped our advertising thereon. And we axed the clever big, you know, well, if we did any cross-track stuff again, it was all around food facts as far as I remember, because, you know, you can be too clever in your marketing.
That's delicious. You can be too clever in your marketing. Like, unpack that a little bit more, because I think there's a lot in that.
Well, I mean, I think you can be too clever in your marketing. When a Covent Garden Soup Company, when we first felt we had enough money to advertise, we advertised in the colour supplements and, you know, magazines, which were then the kind of most obvious place to do sort of, you know, high quality, beautiful advertising. So the Weekend Press and, you know, lifestyle magazines. And we took on a big shot, you know, coolest in London advertising agency, called Bogle Bartle Hegarty, who I don't know if they still exist now, but anyway, they were the...
Was that Sir John Hegarty?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I think he's on post on LinkedIn, so yeah, he's still quite active.
Okay. Yeah. No, I know John Hegarty is, but I think they got taken over or whatever. I mean, it was a long time ago. And they had done all the coolest ad. I mean, I won't even tell you because it would just show my age if I start telling you about the ads that they did. But they decided they wanted to take on a new young brand. So we were very, you know, flattered that they were going to take us on. And they looked at, we up until then, we had built up our brand on good old-fashioned story-based PR. You know, Covent Garden Soup was driven by PR. And I still think it's a case study, and I don't think anything's changed, by the way, because, you know, building a brand on social media is all about content. It's all around stories. And we just manufactured stories. We were full of stories. You know, we all, you know, embodied the brand. And so everything we did was around stories. And people would say, oh, yeah, thing about, you know, big company people would say, thing about PR, it's fine. But, you know, once you've launched a new product, everyone's not interested until you launch another product. I'd say, no, you know, we found that the more you talk, the more people wanted to talk to you. And there was always something to talk about. What sort of, you know, we were test driving new cars. I had this thing. We were just down the road. So in North London, we were just down the road from the BBC, and the BBC discovered that we were there. And so they would ring up and say, the trade figures are out. Do you have a view on it? And I was thinking, well, I don't at the moment, but by the time you get here, I've got a view on them. Just come up here. And they would, the BBC in those days had to have sort of fresh footage. They wouldn't use sort of archive footage. So they had to, you know, they had to film something, you know, in real time. And so I'm finding a manufacturing business within 2 or 3 miles of Shepherd's Bush was pretty difficult. So they would come up and I would just have a view on everything, trade figures, you know, I mean, all these things that, I mean, I got quite good at it, you know.
Thank you so, so much for listening. It honestly means the world to me. I hope you enjoyed your morning coffee, and go and have an amazing day. Let's be having ya. If you want the full episode, it will be in the show notes. A link will be in the show notes for the full episode. Thank you so much. Please leave friends as well. It means the world to me.